expecting to find DNA in the Mars meteorite simply because DNA is not stable over hundreds of millions or billions of years.
Former head of the Celestial Mechanics Division at the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., Tom is absolutely, unquestionably not a flake, and he has done some very wondrous and interesting science, piecing together the orbits of comets and asteroids, and came up with about 20, 25 years ago with the idea that all those little bits and pieces of rock and ice and whatever that's out there that are orbiting the sun in some very peculiar orbits can all be traced back to an explosion event between Mars and Jupiter, and that event would have been the destruction of a rather major additional planet in the solar system, which no longer exists.
So knowing this was coming, this race may have, for a time, colonized Mars.
Or maybe they didn't know it was coming, and because they were colonizing a lot of other places in the solar system, the things they put on Mars basically...
Instead, what was happening was that there were high winds that were uncovering the dark material, dark rocky stuff, by blowing off bright fine particles. And the changes that we've seen on Mars happened during the course of the mission are consistent with this kind of idea. So it looks as if the seasonal changes of Mars are not due to biology, but due to weather. We calculate that the winds are maybe as much as 200 miles an hour in such a storm. And so you have to have very high winds to make that thin Martian atmosphere pick up fine particles from the surface. So while most of the time it may be nice and calm, there are storms which are much more violent than any we see on the Earth. Now, if you have very fast wind picking up all this fine-grained sand, that's a source of erosion and abrasion, much more serious than any wind-blown erosion we know about on the Earth. It breaks things up, makes things collapse. It also picks up things and denudes the landscape of overlying sand and dust. An exceptionally dynamic environment, in some respects like the Earth, in some respects quite different. It's its own planet. Old parts of Mars, which are cratered by chunks of rock falling down into Mars and making holes. In some of those craters, there are these strange black splotches. At least some of those splotches, on closer inspection by Mariner 9 cameras, turn out to be vast sand dune fields. Another indication of wind-blown sand and dust on Mars.
There is a similar dune field in the Mojave Desert in Southern California. That is, the overall form of the two fields and the height and spacing of the larger dunes are alike. However, the complex pattern that we see here shows that the wind directions change frequently. On Mars, the wave pattern indicates a consistent wind direction.
Here is an astounding feature which no one expected on Mars. An enormous rift valley, almost 3,000 miles long, comparable to the largest such feature on the Earth, a sign of great geological activity.
In this model, the flat surface of a large Martian plateau is cut by the Great Rift. A smooth sloping ravine drops abruptly to the bottom of the canyon 4 miles below. Small peaks on the canyon floor were once part of the plateau surface. Today, this great fracture in the crust of Mars is 75 miles across. The original fault has been widened and shaped by various forms of erosion. Great landslides are triggered by quakes that shake the crustal rocks. Wind-blown dust strips the receding canyon walls.
poles of Mars are more complicated than the poles on the Earth. They consist of a small permanent deposit of frozen water ice, permafrost, with a larger amount of frozen carbon dioxide that changes with the seasons. In the winter on Mars, carbon dioxide goes directly out of the atmosphere into the solid form. Carbon dioxide has no liquid phase.
Is so seemingly desolate, apparently covered with little water or oxygen, what could live here today? Some side canyons may have been deepened by running water. Melting of underground ice, followed by slumping of walls, further erodes the Great Fault. Seen only a small part, is so huge that it would span the United States. And the Grand Canyon of Arizona would fit inside one of the smaller tributaries.
And as another and even more spectacular sign of geological activity on Mars is this enormous volcano, hundreds of miles across. It's the largest volcano in the solar system so far as we know. It's a young object because it doesn't have very many impact craters in it, meaning the geological activity on Mars has been occurring in very recent times.
Talking about that there's nothing there, but it restricts the light and shadow, etc., 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 up until December of last year, when in his latest book called The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark, what a title, he says in chapter 3, but I might be wrong. And then he proceeds to lay out specifically why the Sidonia problem, the face on Mars problem, the pyramid problem at Sidonia is different from UFOs, is in fact science, is in fact testable. And then he demands, implores that the next missions going back, i.e. Surveyor, Pathfinder,
sure,
the Russian 96 mission, they take the photographs to once and for all.
What atomic or rock face, and anyone looking at that must wonder, is that what all the fuss was about? What we had seen in the Viking photos from 20 years ago. So the first task was to figure out where were the features in the Viking photo, and how had we been fooled.
Right.
And the subsurface that we can expose that to today with the technology that's available to us. So, the evidence, do the logic correctly, such that we can have in 2021 a report, official report, on light detection coming out of NASA, where the first three statements are incorrect about what was being done in Australia to detect microbial fossils, what was done in the Viking state to detect microbial. These were all statements that were culturally statements that were not written statements.
Now, one last point for Robert, right?
Very good.
Microbial fossils are very difficult to characterize. So if you get a person sediment for 3.5 billion year old fossils, they will argue about this wrong. And that's perfectly reasonable. It's how you manage the public relations. Because there are people out there, you can go onto a web page any day now and read people who say that there is this problem.
Really be the back edge of a flying saucer? Let's find out what our experts think. We start with astrophotographer Andrew McCarthy. For billions of years, our solar system has been bombarded with objects. Could this be a meteor that streaked from out of the sky?
Take a look at the moon. On the surface of the moon, there's a crater called Messier A.
Atlas is a model of the volcano. Its base measures 370 miles across, and the peak stands 15 miles above the plain. The flanks of the crater bear the familiar tortured patterns left by violent eruptions of molten rock. The walls drop steeply to a scarred, blackened floor. Frozen lava lakes mark with rough circles where the interior fires of the planet forced their way to the surface and built a mountain. This is where the atmosphere of a planet is born, in searing heat that transforms solid primitive rock into thin vapors. Today, the crater looks dead, frozen into a rigid page in a textbook on the evolution of a planet. This is not an old volcano. To a geologist, it is young. And no one can say if it is alive or dead. In this volcanic field near Flagstaff, Arizona, there are hundreds of volcanic vents, some as old as 2 million years. The youngest of these, Sunset Crater, is similar to the small volcanoes we see on Mars. And the lava flows are the same as those we see on the flanks of the larger volcanoes.
I'm standing beside the basaltic lava flow that comes out of Sunset Crater, and the great jumble of rocks that you see here are caused by the fact that the lava comes out as a liquid, but it chills on the outside, and the interior of the flow keeps moving, and it breaks up the outer edge into this great mass of jumbled blocks. It's very similar in size and form to the lava flows that we see on Nyx Olympica on Mars. In many Mars photographs, we see long, sinuous ridges that go across the great lava plain. We're sitting on a feature that's very much like those. We think the way this feature formed is that the still liquid lava down in the center of the flow keeps exerting pressure. It lifts the top up, finally breaks it, and then squeezes out through the frozen crust.
And here is something which no one guessed would exist on Mars at all. This is one of hundreds of little channels. This is actually not so little. This is a few hundred miles long. Channels which look for all the world as if they've been cut by running water. Here's a close-up of the inside of one of those channels, and it has the characteristic pattern of terrestrial stream beds. The trouble is, there isn't any liquid water on Mars. The pressure on Mars is so small that it can't keep a lid on liquid water.
Either now or in the distant past. It will take the return of soil samples. Martian meteorites come for free, but the problem is we have no idea of what part of Mars they came from. The best strategy will be to send landers to Mars, to places where the geological evidence indicates that water may have existed recently in the geological past, and return samples from there. In particular, also digging down below the immediate topsoil layer, which is sterilized by the UV radiation, to the subsoil that may still harbor ice or liquid water.
Determine if life presently exists on Mars. The answers on how to detect Martian life are found aboard the Viking lander that rests on the planet's surface. Its cameras, with their mirrors, show us what is on the planet. Yet, they are controlled from the Earth. Certain instruments measure the velocity of the winds and provide information on a variety of surface and subsurface conditions. After traveling 440 million miles for nearly 1 year, one of the most important things this craft must do is to reach into the Martian soil and return a sample to the lander. This would be an easy task on Earth, but on Mars, machines must act as our hands.
Now, this is Mars as seen through a telescope. 7.5 months, the space probe Mariner 4, that is over on that side, has been heading for Mars at 30,000 miles per hour. Later tonight, it will fly past the planet at a distance of 6,000 miles, and it will take 21 pictures of Mars' surface. Early tomorrow morning, it will begin transmitting these pictures back to Earth. It's 134 million miles away. The signals will be picked up on receiving aerials of that type down there. And if this is successful, it will be a record in long-distance communications. These pictures will be transmitted bit by bit, and not until Saturday will scientists see the first close-ups of the Martian surface. To have steered the spacecraft a total of 350 million miles to her target is, of course, a fantastic achievement. It is, in fact, equivalent to hitting a farthing at Calais with a bullet fired from Dover. But the great question is, what will Mariner reveal? Of course, the possibility of life on Mars has been debated for many years. Faint lines seen on the surface have led to the idea that these were canals dug by the Martians, but I don't think anybody goes that far these days. A final answer to the tantalizing question will probably have to wait for a soft landing on Mars with a spacecraft, but that is still a few years away. Meanwhile, there is no lack of speculation about life on Mars and
the problem that astronauts and colonists in the near future are going to have to face. The question is, how exactly close is the Martian timescale to Earth's? And will astronauts visiting Mars in the near future be forced into a completely new dimension of time? In an irreversible succession from past to present and on into the future. While the most widely used numeral system on Earth is the decimal or base 10 system, a system that most likely originated because it was easy for humans to count using all 10 of their fingers, there are roughly 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of darkness during each observed equinox, and 60 originating from... well, I don't really know, but it does divide pretty nicely with smaller numbers such as 10, 12, 15, 20, and 30. Which makers ever thought about, though, is how would this system work among humans living on another planet?
That really... Back now to Richard Seale. Richard, you're back on the air again.
Sounds like New Mexico.
Yeah, I know. We get a lot of that lately, haven't you?
Yes, it's gorgeous. It really is. One of the things I missed when I lived in San Francisco was that we never got thunderstorms. And one night, very late, many years ago, a front rolled through across the Pacific.
Yeah.
And we had thunderstorms. Every of the containers on the top of the spacecraft, kind of equilibrating, you know, between first and the second and third experiment, everybody got their samples, and then the instruments went to work. Now, what NASA had done is to go to TRW, which is a major aerospace company in Southern California, and they had built into about a cubic foot of space. Cubic foot is about, what, the size of your monitor, maybe?
Right.
They had built an incredible, complex, remote-controlled biochemistry laboratory. One cubic foot, and set it 40, 50 million miles away to Mars and set it down on the surface. And the idea was that this laboratory would sniff, sample, and, you know, examine the stuff going on in the three chambers and report from three different experiments whether there were any microbes in the soil.
Let me represent the average person now. That was a long time ago, Richard, and as far as I knew from then, there wasn't much to be announced. And now, all of a sudden,
the three experiments which had, quote, positively detected life, couldn't. That in fact, it was what they called funny chemistry, having to do with a very weird surface, a highly oxidized, a super oxidized surface of Mars, given its peculiar history and environment, and And in fact, it was only chemistry, it wasn't life. Everybody go home and nobody get excited. Well, one guy wouldn't go home. His name is Gil Levin, Dr. Gilbert Levin. I think I've discussed him a couple times on the show briefly.
You have, yes.
And he ran a company called Biospherics Inc. And he and his co-investigator have insisted for 25 years that their experiment, in fact, did detect microbial life in the soils of Mars, and NASA simply changed the rules in mid-game.
Why?
Well, that's a huge political discussion, and I don't want to kind of get off into politics tonight.
All right, okay.
And what that is a shallow meteor impact that came in at a very shallow angle and carved out elliptical-shaped craters. This is how a normal asteroid crash would look, but comes in at a shallow angle. However, on this specific trail leading up to the object, you don't see much of that. This object itself is still intact. There is speculation that it could potentially be the heat shield off of a probe that got ejected into the Martian surface.
Since 1960, there have been around 50 attempts to send probes directly to Mars, but only about half have been successful. Is this disk the remnant of a failure?
If you look at the trench this object crashed down, it looks pretty wide and deep. To me, that rules out any kind of heat shield crash, because the heat shield from a probe wouldn't necessarily have enough energy to carve out such a trench.
So if it's not man-made, could we be looking at the remains of an alien spaceship? For that answer, we turn to NASA geologist Bob Anderson.
This area is called Candor Chasm, which is parallel to the Valles Marineris. Valles Marineris is the Grand Canyon of Mars. It's a huge rift, a crack that's 7 miles down and would go the distance of Los Angeles to New York. Valles Marineris is covered by volcanic plains, a combination of sedimentary layers and volcanic lava flows. These long streaks that you see going across the surface here, those are common all over Mars.
What looks like the trail of a crashed UFO is actually an ancient geologic crack in the surface of Mars. But if it's a natural crack, how did the object at the end of the trail get the perfect curve of a spaceship?
If you look really closely, you can see this one just happens to be perfectly arcuate here, most likely because the winds are coming over and then they're falling into the crack. And the only thing that's given everybody the idea that it's a spaceship is those dunes that are around the front that make it look like there's a circular disk.
But McCarthy isn't convinced.
To me, this object doesn't seem to have gotten here through natural processes.
Well, it didn't take too much work to begin to match up one for one. And then we came to realize that we've realized that in this new image that we were looking from far, that once we got the perspective right, we saw that we could not see significantly over the nose bridge at all. We were only looking at the west side, more or less in profile, of what was the face that was visible in the original images.
Aha!
More than that, in the original images, the sun was also, and only the east side, the side we couldn't see, was in bright sunlight. The side we could see was entirely in color than before, and certainly eliminated the trick of light and shadow effect if everything significant that we could see is in shadow. So we had to we had to allow for the fact that there was considerable projection distortion this time that wasn't there before, just because of our low viewing angle.
Well, additionally, I believe that Dr. Malin, with the cloudy conditions at the moment of the photograph, he admitted to that somewhere down line. Is that correct, Doctor?
Yes, that's right. That is correct. And so all of this contributed to not immediately being able to see in the images what was actually there. But once we got the perspective right and locked in, and anyone looking at the images that are now on the JPL site, which have been properly image processed, see this. If you look at the nose bridge and follow along that, and keep in mind that you're only then seeing the profile of the west side of the face, it will pop out, and you can see the face as it originally was. And when that happens, you see that actually there's a very good semblance of a half of a face there. seen from this low angle. Dr. Carlotto has reconstructed what this would look like as seen from overhead. He can do that because he has height information on the face from the old Viking images. There were several of those, and two of the better ones allow you to get a stereo view. You can get height information. You can use that height information. The height of the nose is different than the height of the enclosure and the height of the forehead. So
and I think that's, I think that summarizes this in a way that it's, exciting enough for people to...
That's right. It's a big process.
It's a big process.
So part of the instruments on board on Perseverance are going to be looking for evidence of life, but we're also packing up samples to bring home. So, Lee, can you post our first poll question? We're wondering what everybody thinks about the chances of Perseverance actually finding evidence of life itself.
For sols to come as Perseverance explores in Jezero Crater and beyond. And so there's the obvious one that we... Okay, so think rover that we've never... Do you hear those little clicks? So that's a laser on Mars, which is pretty cool. So I think this is a phenomenal tool that we... an instrument that we have on this rover that we've never had before, and I look forward to hearing sounds for sols to come as Perseverance explores in Jezero Crater and beyond. Okay, so thinking a little bit about what rovers do on Mars to answer all of our amazing science questions, there are several functions. So there's the obvious one that we talked about, driving. Curiosity, I think the longest drive we've ever done in a planned sol was like 120 meters maybe. So, you know, you can think about the length of a football field is about how far you can go in a planning day. I believe that Perseverance will be able to go further eventually because of some more autonomous driving and different software that they've, you know, vamped up from the Curiosity rover. So you could expect something similar, maybe faster than Curiosity. The really other cool thing that Pablo talked about is that Curiosity has one arm, Perseverance has two. It's got a special little arm underneath for caching its samples. And on that robotic arm, there are several tools. Curiosity has a drill, which Perseverance has as well. We've got a dust removal tool to help clear across the dust on Mars. Mars is very dusty. It's everywhere. So if you want to actually see what billion-year-old rocks are made of, you've got to clear all that dust off first. So Curiosity has an alpha particle X-ray spectrometer that we use to get elemental composition. We also have a MOLLE hand lens. So if any rock geologists out there know that when you go into the field, you got to have your hand lens. Curiosity has one of those, and Perseverance has its equivalent with Pixel and Sherlock. So basically, these are tools that you can do contact with. Perseverance has them, Curiosity has them. So essentially, you use the mast first to determine what you want to get to, you drive to it, and then you use your arm to get this more fine tool, either chemical information or really close-scale morphological view with the hand lens on Curiosity. And one of the primary ways that we are going to collect sample is drilling on Mars. And so we do this on Curiosity. We just finished a drill campaign right now on Mount Merkur. These are really exciting times during rover operations. Drill campaigns usually last about 3 weeks. And it's this really iterative process where you know, the science team works really hard to pick out a code.
So why Mars is so important for us biology? Well, first of all, it's very close. So we actually can test a lot. We have dozens of missions to Mars. You don't have to wait a decade for the next launch. You have to go over Titan or anything else on the outer Mars resources. We can launch pretty much every 2 years a mission to Mars. So we can explore it really, really vigorously. Mars is in many ways similar to Earth, right? It's rocky. If you look at the composition, what it's made out of, it's actually very, very similar to Earth. And yet it's very different. It's very cold, it's very dry, it doesn't have ocean on the surface. So, if we find life there, then that would actually will mean that life is a very common phenomenon in the galaxy. Because if in one solar system, two planets have two separate origination supply from somewhere else. And chances are that this is a very common thing. As long as we have this working planets, we can form life anyway. So that's why it's important. So, having said that, Mars' surface is a very harsh place for Earth-like life to live. So if you put any advanced life without kind of any protection, will die immediately. Some microorganisms can live there, but the reason why it's so harsh is because it's cold. It's colder than Antarctica. It's not uncommon on Mars to have temperatures like minus 50, minus 60 Celsius.
Put all that information in and you can correct for the parallax or distortion and reconstruct what the face would look like viewed from above.
So you virtually end up with a three-dimensional image.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, on Dr. Carlotto's website is the stereogram, two images side by side from a slightly different angle, computer reconstructed from all the information and the new image. And it's possible to view those and fuse the two images while you're viewing them and see the whole Mesa in three dimensions. It is a shocking experience to see that Mesa in three dimensions.
Well, okay, Doctor, what do you conclude from it?
Just describing what we see first, and then I'll tell you the bottom line.
Sure.
The surrounding desert is remarkably flat and featureless. Suddenly, out of this flat, dark, featureless desert, we have a 400-meter tall enclosure that completely surrounds the mesa. It's a very regular height all the way around.
Sort of like the objects that rise from the flatness of Giza.
The enclosure itself is fairly uniform in height, perhaps tapering off very gradually to the north. The sides are perfectly straight, as that report noted. The top, not counting the ornaments on it, the top is perfectly straight. The top and the sides make 90-degree angles. Corners are usually associated with constructed objects rather than natural objects. The bottom is smooth and round, and the whole enclosure is quite symmetric. It is complete except for a tiny area in the lower east corner, which might possibly be an entranceway. We don't have detail on the east side, so we can't really tell what it is.
Generation to dream. Think how inspired we will be to see a landing on Mars. Perhaps then we will look back at Earth and see that is one people instead of many, and perhaps then we will look back at Earth as we struggle to survive on Mars and realize how precious the home planet is. 100 times thinner than on Earth, and it's not breathable. It's 96% carbon dioxide. It's really cold there. The average temperature is minus 81 degrees, although there is quite a range of temperature. A day on Mars is about as long as a day on Earth, plus about 39 minutes. Seasons and years on Mars are twice as long as they are on Earth. And for anybody who wants to strap on some wings and go flying one day, Mars has a lot less gravity than on Earth, and it's the kind of place where you could jump over your car instead of walk around it. Now, as you can see, Mars isn't exactly Earth-like, but it's by far the most livable other place in our entire solar system. Here's the problem. Mars is a long way away, 1,000 times farther away from us than our own moon. The moon is 250,000 miles away, and it took Apollo astronauts 3 days to get there. Mars is 250 million miles away, and it will take us 8 months to get there, 240 days. And that's only if we launch on a very specific day at a very specific time, once every 2 years, when Mars and the Earth are just aligned just so, so the distance that the rocket would have to travel will be the shortest. 240 days is a long time to spend trapped with your colleagues in a tin can. And meanwhile, our track record of getting to Mars is lousy. We and the Russians, the Europeans, the Japanese, the Chinese, and the Indians have actually sent 44 rockets there, and the vast majority of them have either missed or crashed. Only about a third of the missions to Mars have been successful. And we don't at the moment have a rocket big enough to get there anyway. We once had that rocket, Saturn V. A couple of Saturn V's would have gotten us there. It was the most magnificent machine ever built by humans, and it was the rocket that took us to the moon. But the last Saturn V was used in 1973 to launch the Skylab space station, and we decided to do something called the shuttle instead of continuing on to Mars after we landed on the moon. The biggest rocket we have now is only half big enough to get us anything to Mars. So, getting to Mars is not going to be easy, and that brings up a really interesting question. How soon will the first humans actually land here? Now, some pundits think if we got there by 2050, that'd be a pretty good achievement. These days, NASA seems to be saying that it can get humans to Mars by 2040. Maybe they can't. May not be able to get us there until 2040, or we may get there a long time before NASA, but NASA has taken a huge responsibility in figuring out how we can live on Mars. Let's look at the problem this way. Here's what you need to live on Earth: food, water, shelter, and clothing. And here's what you need to live on Mars: all of the above plus oxygen. So let's look at the most important thing on this list first. Water is the basis of all life as we know it, and it's far too heavy for us to carry water from the Earth to Mars to live. So we have to find water if our life is going to succeed on Mars.
If this is due to running water on Mars, it must have been made at a time when the Martian climate was very different from what it is today. At a time when Mars had much more Earth-like conditions.
This is a model of a section of a 3-mile-wide channel north of the Martian equator that seems to be formed by a broad flow of liquid water. It is similar to drainage channels on Earth that are fed by rainfall. Parts of this channel also show evidence of wind erosion and softening of contours. Similar to sandbars formed by rivers on Earth. It might be heavy gravel or perhaps solid rock.
I personally don't see any escape from the idea that running water is what carved out those channels. But if that is the case, then we must imagine that Mars was one time, not so long ago, very different from Mars today. Right now, we have a Martian atmosphere which is thin, a surface which is cold. When those channels were cut, if they were cut by water, and I think they are, then you must have had a much thicker atmosphere, much warmer conditions, and a lot more water around than you have today.
Volcanic eruptions are the source of water on Mars. With each eruption of lava, water vapor is spilled out in the atmosphere. It is stored in two different ways.
The first way is in the residual polar caps. This is the north pole of Mars, and the cap shrinks down to about 5 degrees. It starts at the end of winter almost 50 degrees across, and we think that polar cap is very thin carbon dioxide ice, and it shrinks very quickly to this little residual cap, and we're still debating as to whether that's water ice, carbon dioxide, or dry ice, or a mixture of the two. The second way that it's stored is in these regions where the frost has disappeared from the surface, but we think is still stored underground as permafrost, that is, water frozen into the pores of the rock. We were able to photograph several different kinds of clouds with Mariner 9. This photograph is of one of these clouds. It's the edge of the North Polar Hood. It covers the whole northern region of the planet, and this is the southern edge of the hood. Here you see an ice rim crater and the clouds that form downwind. By measuring the temperature and the elevation, we're able to understand the composition of these clouds. This particular cloud, the temperature was critical, and we know that it was made of dry ice or carbon dioxide ice crystals. Near the great volcanoes, we saw clouds that were much lower and much warmer. We also got spectral lines that proved that these clouds were composed of water ice crystals.
Just as the study of the climate of Mars should, I think, help us understand the climate of the Earth, I think the study of the biology of Mars will help us understand the biology of the Earth.
The big question for the biologist, what is life? What do we mean when we say life? We're really only familiar with one form of life, terrestrial life.
Terrestrial life, life on Earth, carries a trademark revealed by biochemical analysis. All living things on Earth are composed of combinations of molecules, some as simple as water, which is fundamental to life as we know it, others of great complexity. One of these combinations, proteins, forms the enzymes that direct the complex chemistry of life. Another, nucleic acids, are genes contained in chromosomes, the basic unit of life. These combinations of molecules distinguish living things from non-living systems. One other element needed to make a living system work is a method of reproduction. DNA is a molecule containing the genetic message, the blueprint for future generations. Genetic code is the same for all living creatures, for all life, which means that there is really only one form of life on Earth.
If there is life on Earth, then there will be a simply fabulous expansion of the perspective of the biologist. Because all the organisms on the Earth, even though they seem to be different, are fundamentally the same. Their chemistry is all identical. And they're just wrapped in different kinds of wrappings. Less bacteria, less people, less plants, less protozoa. We're all the same on the inside. Now the question is, are Martian organisms the same on the inside as us? Is life everywhere, does it have to be the same as us? Or are we just one example of a vast array of possible kinds of biochemistry? Well, there's no way for us ever to answer that question, no way for us to determine the generality life on Earth, except by looking for life elsewhere. And the nearest candidate planet is surely Mars.
In 1976, two Viking spacecraft will place landers on the surface of Mars.
Viking lander is the first step in searching for the answer to a question that can change man's way of thinking. This desolate planet, if it has life, could alter the thought that Earth alone has living creatures upon it. So the journey of the soil back to the lander is one of great importance. Once the material reaches the spacecraft, it is sifted as it falls through an opening into the interior of the lander. Some of the material falls into a chamber where it can be tested for the presence of life in a biology experiment. In this chamber, the soil is moistened with a liquid that includes food that Earth microorganisms thrive on. A sample of the Martian atmosphere is pumped into the chamber and then the weight. There are microorganisms acting upon the food in the soil. They will give off a gas. The gas will mix with the Martian atmosphere, and when it is analyzed by chemical detectors, it may reveal that life is present.
one major objective is to search for life in the Martian soil.
But what kinds of life forms might cope with the special problems of Mars? The Mars atmosphere allows deadly ultraviolet radiation from the sun to penetrate to the surface. Life forms on Mars may have silica shells to protect them against the radiation. We know that Mars is very dry. Life forms on Mars may have developed special ways of preserving their water content, and those forms may not look familiar to us. I can even imagine forms of life having leaf-like structures, oriented by the sunlight, possibly of unusual colors. This is one of the reasons that we want to have color in our cameras. I could imagine a kind of plant. A plant is perhaps how one would identify it, that is indeed an ice eater, with fine root-like structures, searching not for liquid water, but searching the permafrost, reaching down to get at that ice. Another solution to the problem of water might be an organism that eats rock, one that literally picks up the rock, eats the water, and spits out the rock. An imaginative idea, but not wholly ridiculous. We don't know of such creatures on Earth, but it is possible, and people have speculated along those lines. We're not quite sure how to search for life on Mars. We do the obvious. Microorganisms, the small creatures, are always associated with higher forms of life. So it's microorganisms we're searching for. A small microbe could adapt itself, possibly, to the cold Martian winter, to the dry Martian summer, to hostile Martian atmosphere, or even to the sub-zero temperatures of the Martian night.
This is a full-scale model of the lander spacecraft. This device contains a 10-foot extendable boom. It reaches out, picks up a soil sample, and returns it to an instrument inside the spacecraft, which will then perform three life search experiments. The first experiment will assume that Martian life is similar to Earth life. It uses Martian soil and Martian atmosphere. The soil is soaked in a liquid containing a large quantity of water with a mixture of foodstuffs used by microscopic life on Earth. If Martian life forms eat the nutrients, they should excrete gases in the process, as do microorganisms on Earth. This will change the gases in the test cell. Any changes will be detected and will be evidence of life processes. The second experiment is half Martian and half Earth. The soil sample is moistened with only a little water containing foodstuffs that scientists think exist on Mars. The foodstuffs are tagged with radioactive carbon-14. If life processes take place, then carbon gases released in the process will contain the radioactive tracer and can be detected. The third experiment is based on Martian conditions. It uses Martian soil, Martian atmosphere with scarcely any moisture, to which is added radioactive carbon gases, and simulated Martian sunlight, minus the ultraviolet radiation.
One's first impression is, wow, that enclosure is impressive because it's so regular and so symmetric. Then you look at the mesa itself, which is what's inside of the enclosure. On the mesa, after you have a trowel separating it from the enclosure, is this face-like object. Face-like object has a well defined and traceable forehead, and left eye socket visible. Just the bare corner of the right eye socket can be seen peeking out from behind the low part of the nose bridge.
So between the old Viking photos and the new photos, we have symmetrical shapes.
Yes, that's right. They do match up very well once one gets the perspective, and especially if you do as Mark Carlotto did and correct for the different parallax, then there's an almost perfect match.
All right, and if I may stop you for one moment, Richard, where may that corrected enhanced photograph be viewed?
Okay, if you go to your website, www.arcbell.com, or the Enterprise Mission website, www.enterprisemission.com, all one word, lowercase.
Right.
It is the first item at the top of the homepage. There is a subset image of the two views side by side, Dr. Carlotto's orthogonal rectified version and Tim Parker from JPL's earlier geometrically rectified version. You click on that, you'll go to a page which has a kind of a full display graphic with Tom's great quote at the top. And below that are direct links to Dr. Carlotto's website with his preliminary paper, a step-by-step description of how he got this image from the same raw data we all saw and threw our hands up over about 4 days ago, 5 days ago.
All right, Richard.
And below that is Van Flandern's also commentary.
All right, hold it right there.
The event of what presumably was a parent planet to Mars. Mars was its moon, keeping its same face toward the parent, was around. There is a complete absence of stray features on this mesa. Although there are additional features on the face, they appear to be of an ornamental nature that fits in with the face theme, the fact that it has a headdress and possibly a crest.
And so the NASA administrator has to be able to say, we have a plan of work.
Yeah, except that. I've been to plenty of those.
There is
no time. And I strongly believe this should be done. Where you say, design a Mars sample return mission with no planetary protection requirements incorporated into it. How would you design that? And what would it cost? And the answer is, you could design have a two-stage Mars ascent vehicle with a capsule and an MER-sized rover, and you could land it on Mars, and you could go out and grab a sample and put it in the capsule and shoot it straight back to Earth. Okay? In other words, the whole requirement of having to break the chain of contact with the surface, which means you need a whole nother spacecraft in Mars orbit and need to do an autonomous rendezvous and dock to transfer the sample, that would not be in the mission. Okay? Now, putting that extra spacecraft in the mission greatly increases the cost of the mission, greatly increases the risk of the mission, both because of failure of the launch or operation of that spacecraft itself, as well as the possible failure of the rendezvous of the two spacecrafts in Mars. And now, there are even people saying that the sample, when it comes back, shouldn't go to Earth. That Bill Nelson said it should go to the Lunar Gateway. Okay? Because there's too much of a risk of back contamination. So the whole point of the sample return mission is to take a sample from Mars and bring it to Earth, where it can go to 1,000 university laboratories where there's 1,000 scientists with 1,000 instruments, and they can look at it this way, that way, and every which way. Okay? Not so that it could go to a small space station where there's a couple of astronauts who are not even professional scientists with a limited suite of instruments looking at it there. So there you have the planetary, and also in the discussion that I was in, the planetary protection people wanted to incorporate the requirement that if there would be health monitoring equipment on the capsule as it came back to Earth, and if, as it came back to Earth, we no longer had assurance that it was contained in the capsule. In other words, we don't have positive indication that the capsule has broken open, but we no longer have the health monitoring equipment assures that it hasn't, then a circuit should be activated to sterilize the sample through heat. Okay. Now, just imagine this. You're spending billions of dollars in taxpayers' money. You're spending decades of waiting by the scientific community to bring back a sample from Mars, and then you fail to get a health monitoring signal from the spacecraft, and you decide to sterilize the sample, which, okay, A, if there was life in it, you've just destroyed the most important scientific data that was in the sample. B, if there isn't life in it, you've altered the chemistry, okay? and you damage the sample. Okay, all to please this conceit. These people, they, you know, when they're among the scientific community, they say, we're your friends, we're just here to protect you. But then they start levying requirements on the mission that have turned the mission from a mission into a vision. And I'll leave it there. But I do want to bring up another point, which is this, which is if the purpose of the Mars exploration program is to find life on Mars, is focusing it on sample return the correct strategy?
Decorated face, not just a plain face. And the other features seem to be related to the facial features. There does not seem to be a single rock on that mesa which is not purposefully placed there.
Definitely.
So we have very little to for the mind to choose from in making images out of what is actually noise.
Doctor, can you actually put numbers to it yet?
The odds of any one of the features I mentioned, the eyebrow, the pupil, the mouth curl, the nostrils, having correct size, shape, orientation, and location are individually of the order of 1 in 1,000 or less. And collectively, of course, the probabilities multiply. I base that on just having looked at images of thousands or tens of thousands of planetary objects on the moon and on other planetary surfaces, and we just do not see things like this very commonly anywhere else.
So are we...
its shape and the way it seemed to settle into landscape is completely different than any other object we've seen on the Martian surface.
So it seems we have another split decision here. While Dr. Anderson's theory checks all the boxes, McCarthy's point that finding a naturally perfect curve does seem too good to be true. Better on the surface to study Mars quakes. While it finds many, it also detects this. First, an eerie hollow noise, followed by a series of dinks and donks. Then a howl, right out of a science fiction film. What could be making these strange sounds? George Haas is the director of the Cydonia Institute, which argues that ancient civilizations existed on Mars.
NASA's research with Mars found overwhelming evidence that Mars was a wet, green planet, very similar to Earth. It had water, breathable air. Many people think there was a civilization that once lived there and is now extinct. So perhaps we're hearing some type of signals being sent out from Mars from the distant past. Back in 1901, Nikola Tesla claims that he had received radio signals from Mars. So possibly this is the remnant of that communication that we're hearing now.
Another possibility, and go with us for a minute, is that the sounds are emanating from within some large underground structure.
Some researchers believe that sound played a major role in the architecture in the building of the pyramids.
Shattered by a word.
From the heart of downtown Winnipeg, you're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM.